Good morning, everyone. It's lovely to see you all here this morning. My name is Anna Ambrose, and on behalf of Design Centre Chelsea Harbour, I'd like to wish you a very warm welcome to our Conversation in Design series. Before we begin, please can I just ask you to make sure your mobile phones are switched off. Thank you. So to our conversation this morning, influencers and influencers, I think we're in for a real treat. I'd like to introduce our moderator, design writer Henrietta Thompson. And we are delighted that she is joined by three acclaimed designers, Fran Hickman, David Bentheim, and Karen Howes. Please do give them a warm welcome as we discover a panorama of inspirations that shape and challenge their design aesthetic. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for coming. I'm thrilled to be here this morning with our wonderful panel to talk about this really fascinating issue of influence and influencers, which is a subject that has been an incredibly pertinent one, I think, in the last few years of social media, and how the way we find our inspiration and the way we disseminate that has massively changed over the last few years. So there's a lot to talk about, and I think our panel here have each got a very unique perspective. Astonishingly, perhaps it's not that astonishing, but we've been talking around this subject before this event, and I think it's quite amazing that actually nobody on this panel considers themselves to be an influencer. And I think that is something that probably the outside world might disagree with, given that how actually influential all three of you are. But it's not a title that you identify with, and yet in today's society, it's certainly it's something that a lot of people aspire to be is an influencer, whether that's on social media or in the wider realm peer to peer. So, just to kick things off, I thought it would be really nice if we could just. Introduce each of you with a little bit of background on what has influenced you in your working life to date, and then we can talk about what it actually means to be an influencer, whether or not you consider yourselves to be one, what it takes to be a good one, what are the kind of risks and advantages of this new influence economy that we're in, and I think we all know that it does have a dark side as well. Is social media making people more creative or less? The pressure to make everything so Instagrammable and photogenic these days, how is that affecting interior design? There's so many things that we can cover here. So let's start off. Karen, I know that you are celebrating your 25th anniversary this year, and actually you began in the Design Centre, didn't you?
Yes, so we are 25 years this year. I have a number of businesses that span the kind of interior design world. So Taylor House, we're based in Knightsbridge. We have a team of 34. It's growing all the time, which is great. And I might be a bit corny and say that my team are a lot of my influencers because they're young, incredible, passionate talent. I have another business here, TH2 as well, which is based here in the Design Centre. And we were here at a time when it was a ghost town. I mean, there was literally, I think there was two other businesses and things, but it was great. The energy was fantastic. And of course, 25 years ago, we didn't have social media. So I would say my first influencer was the amazing Mary Fox Linton. I'll never forget going to her showroom on the King's Road. It was really ahead of its time. She was really brave and embraced that kind of quite contemporary look. And I also remember going to listen to a talk of hers. And at the end of it, she'd just finished, I think, a college at Oxford she'd been doing. And she said, just remember, you do not spend clients' money on your whimsical creativity, and always remember the client's right because they're the ones that pay the bills. And it kind of, that really stuck with me. I think where I sit, we can talk about this a bit more, is I find the label influencer makes me a little uncomfortable. I presume that nobody knows me. I presume that I just am anonymous. I like feeling that. I like I don't take huge influence from social media. I think it can make designers lazy. I think you need to get out there and you need to be experience things, not just from sitting on your iPad in front of your telly.
Wonderful. Thank you. So, David, give us a little bit more of a...
I think my influences have always been modern. I was brought up under the umbrella of a textile designing uncle, Tibor Reich, whose brand we've just resuscitated, in fact. And he, in the 50s, when it was a very beige and grey world, still after the Second World War, introduced Hungarian colour to a shocked British public of shocking pinks and persimmons and kingfisher blues. And we were surrounded by, we used to visit, my earliest memory was in a textile mill, the sound of the shuttles and these spools, which used to tidy up, which was terribly boring, of all these multicoloured yarns with lurex shot through them. And I think that ability to think freshly, to think beyond the normal package, remained with me. And after that, I suppose it was educationally. I studied abroad. I studied under a Bauhaus team. It was a very rigorous modernist education. And I suppose my heart's always lain there. But I've sort of, at the same time, I'm influenced every time I go to the theatre or the opera by this single view look at an interior or a setting and the other unimaginable things that they bring onto the stage. And I think I've always liked throwing a dash of theatre into whichever work I do, be it commercial or residential.
Wonderful, thank you. And Fran, I know that you consider interior design to be inherently social as well, don't you? So it'd be great to hear a little bit more.
So I suppose my approach for all my different projects is quite specific in that I try to kind of get to the heart of what it is either an individual or a brand is trying to say and trying to kind of achieve from the space. So from that aspect, it's a conversation and it's about trying to essentially tell us design for me is about sort of trying to tell a story without words. So you can kind of do that with materials and textures and colours. And that draws on sort of different references from, all sorts of different varied references. And I think that approach probably came from my BA. I studied media and cultural studies, which was a very new age, I think probably still is, a very new age degree. And I studied all different parts of the world and, music and film and politics, and I could really kind of study whatever I wanted to. So I think it's really about kind of having an interest in the everyday and the everything, and trying to bring as much as many different messages as you can that are appropriate to whatever you're trying to express.
Wonderful. And do you think that in each of your case your influences have changed over the years, particularly when you talk about Mary Fox Linton as being one of your earliest, and do you find that you're inspired by different things today than you were originally?
That's a good question. I think there's yes and no. So I would say that, I'm very influenced by, I think if I hadn't been an interior designer, I'd love to have been in fashion, and if I hadn't done fashion, it would be jewellery, and I think I take a lot of influences from that. Having said that, Mary still is amazing. And So I think it's a mixture on that one. But I think, one needs to... You get influences from not just people, but it can be little... we always say to the team, always keep a sketchbook with you wherever you go, because you can be walking down the street and see an amazing railing detail that you can then convert into a handle or whatever it is. It's everywhere. When you're a designer, you live, eat, breathe it. It's not a 9-to-5 job. You're constantly looking for different sources of inspiration. Traveling, obviously, is the most obvious one.
Well, one of the things that we were just saying before sitting down here was actually how much less probably all of us are consuming media generally, with social or reading things, because our lives are so full and there's so much of it out there. So how do you make sure that you still do experience you know, as much? Is it a question of traveling and making sure that you take time out in your calendar to travel as much as possible to meet the people that, you know, that will inspire you? Or
I think that it's that what we have either trained ourselves or been trained to do is to not sit somewhere and accept what we're looking at. Mm. I think that you look critically at wherever you find yourself. I suppose if I had my life, I suppose I'm a secret psychoanalyst, and I think when you have your clients, you've got to get to the essence of what they are. You're producing couture for somebody because it's very one-off, and you're also, I think, going back to influencing, you're taking somebody and giving them sushi for the first time or avocado for the first time. The first response is, ah! And, you know, frequently I take my clients into B&B, and because most probably, and I'm not saying this in a sexist way at all, but maybe the lady is more malleable or wants to like what I like, and we go into B&B, say, and they look around and absolutely love it, and then their husband's taken along and says, over my dead body. But then they sneak back in 2 weeks' time, and I can't stop them buying it. And that's the influence, is that you take a client and you show them something that they wouldn't necessarily want to look at, or they wouldn't want to be that mixed. But you've also, and as you said, you've got to make it very appropriate to them.
Yeah.
To be successful, you've got to make that person feel a sense that it's theirs. I always want people to say, when they look at something that we've done, say, did you have help in that? Of course they did. And they say, yes, they say, who is it? David Bentham. Now we can see it.
Yeah.
But I won't sell that as a, I don't sell that as sell a product. I want to sell something that will they can claim as their own, but be happy that they've had the relationship to achieve that. I think that's. But my greatest influence was anti-influence. I employed a young girl who had done a course at V&A and wanted to become an interior designer. And after a year's working with me, she told me that she was going to go elsewhere and do a shoe design course, as she saw that being an interior designer was being on the phone from morning to night. And she became L.K. Bennett. So I think she made
okay.
I think she made the right,
right choice.
So that was my best negative influence.
There we go. Fran, what about you? The question's probably morphed a little bit actually now, in terms of how do you make sure that you're being inspired by the right things now? So how do you make sure that you're...
Well, I take a lot of photographs as I go along. I think I've got something, I've just got a new iPhone, and I think my phone is still... I've got something like 40,000 photographs on my phone, which is sort of absurd, and I have to find everything sort of by place now. But I suppose when I take on a new project, those issues become more pressing, and so I become kind of more aware of what might be applicable. So I kind of search through my digital library, it is now, and then I have a reference library. And so I suppose it's just about having a kind of a vocabulary and just working out what... and also trying to sort of make things as simple as possible. I'm always trying to make things as simple as possible because I think, you know, our lives are so busy and fast-paced, and often what we want from space is just sort of rest or relaxation, or sometimes sort of stimulation. But you want to do sort of if you want to sort of stimulate in a space, you want to do it in a very sort of simple way, so that it's not kind of overwhelming. I think we were just talking actually backstage when you were saying when you were studying under a sort of Bauhaus education. And there was a sort of primary influence. Well, there was the primary note, and then there was a kind of secondary supporting note, and then there was a sort of
little
auxiliary note. So I think you often want to say one thing, and then you want to do something to support that, and then maybe there's just another layer of interest beyond that. But you don't really want anything more complicated than that, I think. It's a bit like, I sort of take it back to kind of writing essays. You kind of want a really kind of clear structure about what it is that you want to say, and you want to say that as clearly and concisely as possible.
Mm.
And I think the same in designing a space.
How much do you think that your design process is affected by the, I guess, the pressure to have that photo ready, finish?
Mm. Yeah, we were talking about that earlier, wasn't it? And I said I absolutely do not design thinking about what the end photograph is going to be like. You know, it's a journey that you start, as you say, with your clients, really listening, asking a million questions to get to know them, and really interpreting that and what they want, whether it's a hotel or whatever the project might be. And then for me, the driver is I want to design something that I haven't seen before. I don't want to just copycat. I think that is one of the dangers of Instagram and Pinterest, is that there's a lot of copycat going on and not original and thoughtful design. And that makes me feel quite sad. So I don't ever think about the end.
You don't feel pressure from clients, particularly, I think, in the hospitality industry. Hotels are now looking for that Instagram-ready moment and the vignettes that will then cause their property to be shared.
Yeah, I think you need to, we're always looking for that wow, that I get.
Yeah.
Because you want people to come to your home and go, wow, this is amazing, or walk into an amazing hotel and get that instant impact. But, I think as well, it's quite interesting. In the studio with clients, I am, and I'm very open about this with the clients, so because we're quite a big practice now, I am the kind of editor, I suppose, of what we do, and I am known as the first client with the team. So they have to present to me, and I sit in the client's shoes, because by then I've got to know them really well, so that before it gets to the client. So I suppose, yes, that is what I influence in terms of how it then goes forward. Yeah.
Absolutely. Would you agree with that? Do you feel any kind of pressure?
I had a very naughty architect who I used to work with. He used to call projects one photograph, two photograph, or three photograph jobs, depending on what we had at our disposal. And I spoke to a PR recently, which I constantly do and see what they think of me. It's very little. And it's very interesting when it comes to photographs. I take quite good photographs. But if I photograph one of my schemes, I take a photograph of what the scheme is. A photographer will photograph your scheme in what makes a good photograph. Mm. So there's two very different things at play there. A good photographer ought to be able to make that king shot that sells the brand. So if you're doing a commercial job, that's very important. But that's almost more in the hand of what... It's quite different. You know, when you bring to any group, you get different views of what you're doing. But the photographer's skill is getting the photographer, the photograph. So it's always when you have your work published, you'll say, grungle, because they haven't got this in or they haven't got that in. But their job is to take the photograph. When House and Garden choose their cover, they go to a committee. They don't... It's not the editor. It's not you. It's not any... And it's not how good the scheme is. It's what the public think is going to sell that newspaper. Mm. So that they're all very different points of view. But when it comes to the client, what you want is, whether it's simple, whether it's complex, you want the client to feel possession of that. Mm. Whether it's a brand, whether they're designing a chain of hamburger places, whether I'm working for Wagamama, whatever it is, the client's got to take full possession of that. It's got to work for them, as it does at home. And after that, you hope that... The best thing somebody said to me ever was that I never thought I'd live in somewhere as beautiful as this.
Yeah, I love
the bad thing that happened to her is 3 months later, her husband was transferred to New York for life, and that was the end of that. Yeah. But you raise expectations. I think you also always want to take somebody on a journey. We're all sort of messianic in the way that we work, because otherwise we just do what everybody else does. We all want to find a fresh viewpoint, something that somebody will make it, that you bring your own freshness and personality to. That does come into... There is a bit of vanity involved.
Yeah.
Got to admit to it.
Yeah, you do.
And Fran, many of your gorgeous interiors, the images coming up as well, just on the boards just now, and they're all so incredibly photogenic and just, is that something that influences your work?
I do think photography is really important because a lot of domestic jobs, we photograph them, but they're not, they're private. This is an example, actually. This is a house that we did. We literally just photographed the staircase because you actually can't really see anything of the house. But with the commercial spaces, the images are what drives more work. And because they are public spaces, we try to do something like a little bit more playful. Shop fits, you're always a kind of supporting actor to what the sort of business of the space, which is selling clothes. But when we did Chess Club, which is going to come up at some point or has been up, we did something a bit more decorative, and that actually drove, that for me was a sort of turning point in my business, because people came to the space, sat, drank, ate, and that experience of being in a space was completely different to any other experience that I'd worked, you know, for spaces I'd worked on before, I suppose, in terms of kind of, again, interactivity, I suppose.
Absolutely, and they sit and they drink and they eat and they take photographs of, of where they are as well. And
I have been looking sideways at Fran's photographs, first time I've seen them. I have been knowing photo envy. Admit to it. Interior designers hate each other. I want to have done that job.
I was with a friend of mine who's an architect, and he was telling me this story about Joseph Durand, who you will have all seen this project. His first project that he did was a monochrome apartment in Paris, and apparently it's a very, very small, apparently in the flesh or in reality, actually quite unremarkable apartment. But his brother is an interiors photographer, and they shot the space so well. And not only did they shoot the space so well, but the project is one where you see a desk, and behind it there's a Christopher Wool picture going. You know, there's some kind of slightly abusive text. Anyway, it's quite iconic in terms of kind of contemporary interior design. Anyway, they photoshopped that artwork in. That art was was not in the space. And consequently, the whole apartment is seen through a completely different lens because it was shot well, it had great art, and suddenly everyone thinks it's something tiers above actually what it is.
Which actually takes us to that whole dark side of social media as well. So how much can you really believe what you're seeing?
Well, and a lot of what you see as well are not are CGIs. I mean, a lot of it is just completely...
The CGIs are so good now.
They're so good, you almost... I mean, we did an amazing project. It was a converted church at the back of Harrods. It's one of those game-changer projects that you're lucky to work on in your career. And we only had 3 meetings with the client through the whole 2-year process. And so we did it all. We did the CGIs. And actually, the end product, we had to actually label them in the studio because we couldn't almost tell the difference between the photography and the CGI at the beginning.
Tell everybody what a TGI is.
A CGI, computer-generated image. You don't know. So, I mean, we have now 3 technicians doing that in-house.
Yeah.
A few years ago, we would never have dreamt of that.
Yeah.
But particularly if you're doing overseas projects, you don't have so much interaction with the client. Mm. You know, it's a great resource for the team, for everybody in the project to know actually what it is that the vision is that you're going to be delivering at the end. So that's a really useful tool. But we don't put... I'm looking at my team in case I've got this wrong. I think I'm right in saying you won't find any CGIs on our website, so you will only see completed works.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's difficult when you're starting. You know, how do you get projects? You know, you don't have a portfolio of work. Somebody came up to me the other day at a talk, actually, and said, you know, how do I start? And actually that is, in a way, you could argue, is a good tool that you can show what your work could look like
without actually doing it.
But buyer beware, I'd say, if I was a client. You need to know. Mm. Because I remember interviewing somebody, and they showed me many CGIs and no finished products. And because this particular practice they were working for used to do a lot conceptually, and some of the projects were really large and took a long time. And I said, but you've got the same light in each of your CGIs, and how do you actually know that that light works? And you're repeating it on every project. And so there's, you've got to be a bit careful.
Absolutely. And, you know, and creating a picture-perfect design is one thing, but actually building it and delivering it and working with clients is something else altogether.
Yeah.
Do you feel like with, this kind of the nature of influencer culture, another potentially dark side is that it becomes more important who you know than what you know. I don't know if that's potentially actually always been the case anyway, especially with a field like interior design, like with fashion, it's all about, you know, who you know. And you could say that that's the benchmark of success in any industry. But do you feel like it's become more important, so the number of followers you have or the number of the level of influence that you're perceived to have?
I think it's less obvious than that, isn't it? It's sort of somehow it comes together, people see you about or you see you're published. You may not necessarily get work directly from that, but people know you're alive.
Yes, I think it is. It's just that general awareness, isn't it? Mm. I mean, I have to say, I've said to the team, I don't do very... there's very little personal stuff. They got me to do my own. It was a disaster because I just don't think in that way. I'm definitely not going to put my children on it. And I did put my dog on it, actually. I'm definitely not going to have hair and makeup done at the weekend to appear in this amazing, relaxed, not shot. I don't know. Is it my age, Fran? I am
no,
older than
no,
you.
I, no, no,
but
no.
I just don't get all that stuff. I just don't get all that stuff.
I think what we do, I've always considered, we're all sort of staff, do you know what I mean? I know that's sort of, you know, you're always, we are always working for someone else.
Yeah.
So it's, what's most important is that the client gets what they want. So it's not really, in terms of being, it's not that important for us to be influential in the same way that it might be important for, a movie actress or someone who's going to sort of drive a film or someone whose public profile, you know, means that it drives their business. That's, our business doesn't work like that. We can quite easily and happily work, behind the scenes. And we do work behind the scenes, essentially. Essentially, it's sort of set design, what we do. So I don't think, I mean, we actually, none of us knew each other. Our business is actually not that social, unlike film or music or fashion. Mm. It's all very discreet and private and not showy-offy.
I have to say, it's quite close shop. I mean, I remember when I started, you know, I just... to open up an account even in those days was like, they needed to know
you. Will
they have me? Yeah, exactly. Will they have me? And trying to break through. And I remember the wonderful Gordon Lindsay was, again, amazing support because he was, in this ghost town of what was Chelsea Harbour then and was, really kind of helped and mentored us. But I think it is quite difficult. I'd love to see it a lot more open. It's partly why I lecture about interior design. And talk about it is that I'm really happy to share the experiences I've had in my journey to help other people who are starting out. I think it's really important. But I think as well it is in a thing about, we talked about age. So I'm hosting a summit that we're organising for Business of Design and Property in November, and it's all about engaging the right minds. And it's we're already working. We're fortunate we work for some amazing billionaires, but it's the children. I was at a speaking at a conference about Saudi Arabia yesterday, and half the population is under the age of 18, and it's come 2030, they're the next influencers and what they're looking for. So when we say all of that, and they do sit on their iPads, and that we can't stop what is happening. I'd love there to be some change around it because. My children are 21 and 24, and they just kind of at that age where they have been influenced by it. I don't like some of the influences that the social media brings. I think, though, it's the younger generation who have to make that change. I think that need to be perfect is really really damaging. Mm. I think it's not good. When we talk about in a business context as well as a personal one, we're not perfect. I think that there's too much comparison that goes on social media, and I think it's unhealthy.
I think there's something that hasn't been mentioned today, which social media and Instagram almost preclude. It's everything about Instagram, however one uses it, is about today, occasionally about tomorrow, or occasionally last night. But I think a lot of what we have to do is you work with the culture of the the person and the family and what they have. And it's one of the big issues is what people come to you for, which is a sense of perfection. The way that people live precludes a sense of perfection. Dinah Hall is one of the best Instagrammers. She always produces beautiful things. And actually sort of put us a comment the other day, can't you show something ugly for a change? And she actually took a picture of her kitchen sink and said, well, this is what it's really like. And I think we live in these created photographs of people sort of skipping and dancing, wearing clean clothes, and their children are never sick or vomit or anything like that. But most people have these issues. They have dogs or cats or mice or family photographs. They're the things that people bring to the party. And in a way that a lot of our work, that if people almost, the magazines want to almost discourage that. It's you don't want that past, you want that sort of perfect future and present. And I think that one of the things that is very, very difficult is not only in what the client, you know, you do. I do the buy it and sell, you know, if you didn't have it, would you buy it? Or if that wall wasn't here, would you ask for it to be put up? You know, and you play all of these games, but then the next day after you leave, you'll be invited for lunch or something, and there'll be the most terrible turquoise blue orchids, you know, which sort of are death on the planet, which are proliferating. You can't control that. It's that where, that's where the photograph does get take over. Because for that moment, you have the design in perfect glue and amber. But most people's lives aren't like that. And I've always tried to, whether it's a restaurant, whether it's a hotel, or whether it's whatever, it's make it allowable for people to use the ash, move the ashtrays. David Hicks, who created these extraordinary set pieces, eventually put what he called tablescapes. And that's what he arranged the plants and the vases and the table and the flowers and whatever it was. And then he took to putting a plastic Perspex box over the whole thing so that you couldn't bloody touch it. You know, so therefore he could leave his scheme knowing that he would go back in 3 weeks' time and find, yay, you know, it's exactly the same. And I think that's, it's something I've tried to do, and it's terribly difficult, is to allow people to move the cutlery about and to bring themselves into it. Do you not find
yours
are so deliciously perfect?
Well,
what happens?
Yeah, what happens when they leave the room?
How do you influence that one?
Well, yeah, no, I think you know, you sort of you work on something, particularly commercial projects. You work on them really intensely for a short period of time. So, and domestic can take much longer, so that can feel sort of less intense. But particularly commercial products, which you work on for, you know, really short bursts, yeah, it's sort of handing it over is you've got to.
It's the moment from when you stop being the friend and start to become the enemy.
Yeah, exactly. No, there's a kind of,
you've no place here anymore.
Yeah, no, it's a gradual. It can be it's a gradual handover. But no, it's also great seeing something come to life and be used and enjoyed.
Yeah, we had it recently with the team. We were back at a project we finished in Notting Hill, and the family have moved in, and they're living in the space. And for me, you know, it's how a space becomes a home. Mm. It takes layering. It takes time. It takes, you know, acquiring things on your travels. You know, we'll often keep going back into clients' projects to add another layer. If they're not confident enough to do it themselves or don't have the time, you know, we can still be working on projects 2, 3, 4 years after they've finished, just kind of just refining it.
I guess there's something that's very integral to the subject of influence and being an influencer, is that you do need to at some point relinquish control. It's not about just, you know, creating something, putting it out there and assuming it will be there forever. Just in the same way that I know that there's a school of thought which is that nothing is ever actually original, in, you know, whether that's in art or design, that, you know, everything is always coming from somewhere else. So imitation may be the sincerest form of flattery, but also, you know, we have our ideas whether or not we know where they're from, and then you evolve them, and that's what creates the next step. You know.
Yeah, I mean, I remember I shared a house when I was 18 years old with Martin Waller, who was the founder of Andrew Martin and has been a big influence in my life. And I remember going to him going, Martin, how do you come up with the ideas for all of these things? And he said, there's no such thing as original thought. Mm. It's an adaptation of something. And that kind of, on the one hand, I was a bit, oh. On the other hand, actually, it took a pressure away that actually, you know, and that comes back to almost where we started about getting out there and looking at things and just seeing, you know, where your influences come from.
I think there's got to be a tad of originality in there. I think the big compliment is when you're asked to do their next house or to do another property for them. That's when you realise you've really helped or given them a new pair of eyes. It's almost refreshing eyes. And the other thing as an influence is you tend with certain clients to become their go-to for where should we eat, where should we stay, which hotel,
doctors,
which country.
Doctors, hairdressers.
Exactly. And you become part of that, you know, sort of, you know. And I think that maybe we don't like to call ourselves influencers because it sounds rather vainglorious. But on the other hand, in the same way that if you've got a medical friend and you've got a spot in your nose, you usually say, who's the surgeon I should go to? I think we preserve it in a different way because what we're always doing is looking at things and we're always exploring. I don't think you can be a designer without having an urge to explore.
That's right.
And I think it's in that exploration, whether you're in Namibia or whether you're in sort of the Highlands of Scotland or wherever you go, that you've got to bring. You may not use it, or it may not look like, you know, you're not suddenly going to sort of tartan feathers everywhere, but something from the dawn or something that you've seen or something that's happened to you should find its way eventually through something, even if you don't know it.
Yes, a little nugget of something, isn't it, that you take through.
Would you all agree that actually that's almost one of the best parts of the job, in a way, is getting inspired and finding all this sort of fresh
thought? We were saying, weren't we, backstage, that, you know, the great thing about being a designer is that no 2 days are ever the same. You know, every project's different, every client's different. You know, it's I can't imagine ever getting bored doing what I'm doing, actually.
I always think that, as I'm the oldest by far, is that, and, you know, people say, I'm not going to retire, things like that. It would mean that I could never use the excuse of being a designer to go into a restaurant, cave, or anywhere. I can go there and take my photograph and think, I can use that. Yeah. And therefore, you're constantly having a relationship with what you're seeing because you bring it. You bring it to your table. Mm. But if I stopped working, I don't know what that would be like.
I can't imagine that, actually. I don't know what I'd do.
You're too young.
No, I know. No, definitely not retiring, ever.
I think probably on originality, I think it's also, you can almost compare what we do to sort of cooking in a way. So you sort of take ingredients.
Very much.
That's a good analogy. And you know that some things kind of classically work together and some things have slightly more unexpected flavours when placed close to each other. So I think there's probably a language that we all understand, and then it's just sort of it's how those ingredients are used. And I suppose because all the projects are different, and all the clients are different, no two projects will ever look the same.
That's a really lovely analogy.
It's how you put it on the plate at home. Are you going to try to put tweezers with micro vegetables and micro things on them, or do you plonk it on, or do you do it Nigella way? I think all of these things are so intrinsic to the way that we live and the way that we think and design. I think it's
wonderful. Does anybody here have any questions? Have we got yes?
Oh God, no, it's never perfect. I think we always. I always say if we filmed what we do from beginning to end, I don't know if I'd ever be hired again. Because I mean, part of our job is to deal with the stuff that comes up, you know, and deal with it. But the client never knows that. They see it obviously all perfect. It takes me back. A long time ago. I was pregnant with my first, and therefore, it's an interesting one actually. When you're working with clients who are pregnant, and their decisions, and a designer who's pregnant. Anyway, I designed a pink poof, and it arrived, and the scale and proportion was absolutely ridiculous. And the team said, "I think it's time for you to go on maternity leave now." Because really, but actually, I said to the team the other day, "I think that trend's going to come back again. I think we need to bring back the overscale poof."
Pink poof.
Yeah, I think so.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I don't like anything that I've done until 6 months after it's finished. I walk in and somebody says, "This looks wonderful." They say, "Don't look at the skirting, though. Don't, for Christ's sake, don't look at that."
We are controlling perfectionists, aren't we?
And then And there's the terrible game that you play of sort of moving everything around quickly because it hasn't quite worked, and especially when the client's not there. But I think there is a sort of... what we do, and I found that at art school terribly difficult, that when a ceramicist makes something, they see what it is. You could see what... they had something physical, fashion, you could make it. All of these things, you could actually achieve something. We never achieved anything in that respect. You created a few plans, you tried to make them look nice, you cheated with the proportions, you did whatever it took. But we show people, we expect people to understand a piece of paper this size for what's going to be the rest of their house. And then we might do a few sketches or get some CGIs, or which usually lie and tell them what it's not quite to look like, or if they're wonderful watercolours, it's even more of a lie. But we've got a vague idea that proportion's right because through experience. But I don't know how... and we expect the poor client to actually understand the elevation. Mm. Which isn't, but somehow it all goes together. The huge mistakes... There was one recently, and I do have a very, very, very expensive light fitting in my house because the assistant put the drawing and the plan off the internet of the larger light fitting and reduced it. The larger light fitting had more flowers on it. It's the Mui Herculaneo, and it had more flowers per square inch on it. And the client spotted that. So I and my study now have an £8,000 light fitting, which I've had to take home, but it's very beautiful, so hey. But it happens.
I did a showroom for Moda Operando. It was my first job when I launched my business, which was 4 years ago, almost exactly. And I made all these bespoke rugs, which I didn't have time to sample. And the tufts, I took a couple of days off, which would, well,
I
needed to.
You're holding my hand whilst you're saying this.
And,
you're still traumatised.
And the tufts were chosen by the gentleman making the rugs. Anyway, they didn't turn up quite as planned. So that was a little bit nerve-wracking. But
you're only quite about this much difference.
I don't know. So I think those were all sort of sold off on other jobs later on down the line. But and replaced with all that size, well, actually you can see it there, which was then in turn, in due course replaced with the right rug. But that's just a case of being rushed, really. And then once, an oversized pendant. But you can usually send things back. But it's just you've got to be careful, I suppose.
Damage limitations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for that question. Does anybody else have anything they'd like to ask? Yes.
Yes, I'm not anymore an interior designer after 44 years, but I just want the quote of David was very interesting because I was very lucky to have as a teacher David Hicks, and actually I was with him when he was placing these things, and when he had, for instance, certain clients, including Jacques Onassis, Fifth Avenue in New York, he was on his contract, you had to respect his position of scape. So this is when I said, do I want to be perfect like that? And that gave me the decision not to be perfect. So this is just a little quote because you mentioned David Hicks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody? Any others?
I didn't quite get it. What was the question?
Questions? I think it was an observation.
Good.
It was
just checking.
Unless you have anything to add. Is there a question over?
Oh, come on.
Over here.
I love people who ask questions. When I lecture at KLC, I often will get people in for work experience if they've asked a question.
Yeah, you have to plant them. We haven't planted any.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
Great.
Yay.
I was just...
there's been a lot in the press at the moment about how fashion or interiors is the new fashion. How do you approach the influence of fashion itself? Because in interiors, I think there needs to be more longevity than... say in the fashion world where trends are changing rapidly. Do you count fashion as an influence in what you do?
Well, I mentioned it before, I do. I'm wearing a fabric that I would put on a sofa very happily. It's interesting because we... often do trend reports. We're just working on one at the moment. And often we're ahead of the fashion, actually. So we'll predict what we think the colours are going to be for next year. And lo and behold, it is on the catwalk the following season. So I know that fashion designers like to think that they're ahead of interior designers, but I disagree with that. I think we're ahead of them, actually. If you're, you know, really thinking about what you can start to see a vibe and a feel for what's coming next, because, you know, we're often designing projects that you won't see for 2, 3, 4 years down the line, particularly the show pumps and things we do. We can't choose what's on trend now. We have to predict what we think it's going to be. And I think that's part of our job, actually, for our clients, is to show them this amazing, you know, the choice is quite bewildering, actually, for lots of clients. And it's for us to have the confidence to say, this is what it's going to be. So I'd like to think that our things don't go out of date instantly. It's a very good question, though, and I think, but I think people are becoming a lot braver with their interiors, and I think we're seeing a lot more colour and texture, and that really excites me because I love colour. So.
Absolutely, I think it is a great question, and that whole synergy between fashion and interiors, and how that how those two worlds are changing, and in a way, as you say, you know, sometimes you're ahead of the fashion, and that's a fairly new thing, because it used to be very much, you know, fashion would set the trends, and then it would be interiors would kind of catch up, and but with things that could be, you know, have a little bit more longevity. But now it seems like everybody's finding their inspiration and influences from the same big global mashup pool. Of, and so actually things are happening around, you know, in a much more equal setting in a way. And I know that also fashion brands are starting to get much more involved in interiors as
and
well.
And they're dreadful at it.
Yeah.
I'll tell you something. Very rarely would I recommend that you go and stay in a hotel that's been designed by a fashion designer.
Yeah.
They're dreadful at it.
Really uncomfortable.
You'll find one or two that are okay. And we were just talking about this earlier, and I won't mention Armani Furniture. Cause they, you know. But he makes just the most amazing cutback, simple,
perfect,
wonderful,
suits.
Minimal tailoring. And the furniture doesn't look at all like that. And I can never understand that lack of synergy between the two. Are we influenced by them? I think that I'm influenced by their extraordinary creativity. We have to do it 3 times a year and for different people, and it's like that. We don't have to design summer, winter, 50 outfits. It's an extraordinary mass of creativity. And quite frequently, their shows, their shops are absolutely wonderful looking. As I said, their interiors are something. Where they choose to live is something else. But if you looked at the film of what's his name who took over Dior, need these extraordinary walls of flowers. Who was that?
Ralph Simmons.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. That film was just wonderful in showing the extent of that seasonal one-moment creativity, which was a burst of theatre and fabulousness. And that sort of thinking, being alongside that sort of creativity of looking at the Belgian designers and different people, what they do with fabric, what they do with the... And if you look at your trousers and the whole resurgence of the Chanel suit, and that sort of return to texture... It may not be something you could walk in and say, well, that's Chanel's suit in a chair. But I think there's something about the touch and feel of clothes and the touch and feel of fabric.
But in fact, we're using, for embroidery and things, the same studio that Chanel uses for their clothes. So the crossover, actually, in terms of supplies and things, is getting more and more.
You can see the direct influence. Dress and
I know it looks like a
exactly.
It looks like a cutting board, doesn't it? Dress. Well, I much prefer our pace to the pace in fashion. I think the pace in fashion is exhausting, and I think obviously, you know, the textiles that we work with are, you know, that you're drawing from exactly the same pool. Actually, after this, I'm going to Berwick Street because I'm working on a house which I've got to do a number of guest bedrooms in 3 weeks, and the only way I'm going to be able to, because it's design week, the only way I'm going to be able to do it quick enough is if I spec cloth from Berwick Street, which is sort of ready to wear, I suppose. So that's a very kind of clear correlation. But in terms of trends, I've never really, I know that there are kind of trends within interiors, and this is this sort of millennial pink, But I kind of think that what we do is not really, what we do is not really trend-led, in that what we do is so specific to, as you said, it's like couture. It's about a person or a brand in a space, and that's very specific. And if you're being influenced by trends, then you're not really doing, you're not focused in the way.
Do you feel like that? You know, obviously you mentioned millennial pink and trends and so on. But do you feel like the trends in interiors are now moving faster than ever?
I mean, to be honest, I'm not especially aware of trends in interiors. I suppose, well, clearly there are, because you can clearly read a sort of 50s interior, 60s interior, 70s interior, etc. And you can also, read spaces being specific to a place. So you can read a French interior to a New York interior. So obviously they exist, but there have been certain, I think, kind of magazines, for example, or brands who have become very popular in the last few years. So I think they're probably influential. But trends, I don't know. I mean, I really feel like what we do is so broad, and that we draw from kind of historical design and cultural references, that actually it's sort of beyond trends.
We're living in a time now when there is much more of a melting pot and mishmash of
I think it's changed
anyway.
In the last few years, because, you know, you used to go to a maison and I'm not going to say decorates actually, but you used to go to maison a Milan, and you'd see a very strong trend, and that was kind of driven, you know, is it it's the chicken and egg thing. Is it supply and demand? So the designers want that particular look, so the manufacturers make it, or are the manufacturers dictating the trend? And most of what we do is bespoke, so we can control that. We don't have to buy what is out there. And I think that was the big change for us as a studio, is that we could control it, as opposed to the manufacturers controlling it.
I think it's less, I almost feel like the time we're in now, although I probably feel differently in 10 years' time, it's quite sort of postmodern now, so we kind of draw influences from, you know, the 80s or the 70s or the 60s, and that will feel, and you sort of mix it with something else. But I don't really know what the look would be now. I don't know, I don't feel like we're in the 60s, I could say, oh, it's everything psychedelic or primary coloured or...
I think the thing
plexiglass.
That
70s
get,
seems to be having a revival at the moment as well, and all sorts of.
The thing that makes us wince is the word retro.
Yeah,
it's become a sort of coverall for anything that's a few years ago, and it's used as a stylistic crutch. And I think that in that way, that none of us wants to be trendy, which is we don't want to particularly conform. We each design in a different way. And I think we want to be quite specific in that, and that each of our houses' designs are specific to the culture of each business. And I think that's what drives it most, that you, with unwittingly, you create a culture. And that culture is dependent on everything that happens around you. It's dependent on going to the theatre, it's dependent on going to concerts, it's depending on knowing what's happening. And most probably, when you're younger, you get more of the younger influences, most probably, because there are different things that bubble up. And there's different parts of town. I'm still part of the living in West London side of the world. My daughter's part of living in East London side of the world. And there's different influences when you go there. And it would be a great mistake to only ever live in West London or ever to see that. And in the same way that one travels throughout the world, we've got to travel throughout London, because throughout London there are different views, there are different fashions, there are different things happening. Whether we take all of it, but one would be a fool not to be aware of it and to use these as influences rather than copying them, possibly.
But and then it's rather depressing, because we've been celebrating our 25th anniversary, so we decided we'd make it an early 90s theme and vibe for our party. So I managed to squeeze into my engagement dress, which was very Paddy Shoulders thing. Then I suddenly realised I've become vintage. I'm so old. It's just like some of the team hadn't even
has
been.
Has the party been?
So, it's been. Sorry, it was only for the team, darling. That's why you weren't invited. And it was just like, God, no. Some of the team hadn't even been born by then. So it's kind of.
Dress sounds fabulous, though.
Yeah, I know, it's great.
Wonderful. Oh, we have another question.
What type of
Sorry about you at the back.
Oh, no, you've had a question.
You've had a question already.
You've had a question.
Oh, the young... I want the blonde girl. I want the blonde at the back.
Let's have two.
Hi. Thank you for everything you've shared so far. I just wanted to ask another sort of area of influence. Obviously, you talk about set design and theatre and fashion. How much does architecture influence what you do in terms of, obviously, the existing architecture of a building that you're working with, but also when you're working with architects, is it a symbiotic relationship? Do you offer your vision to them? Do you take on board their visions, perhaps, for the space that you're working on?
Yeah, well, that's a good question as well. I've resisted over the last, particularly in the last 10 years, there are a lot of interior design practices that combine architecture and interior design, and I don't personally agree with that. I like the fact that we work with amazing architects. I like the fact that we keep our discipline separate. So this would be contentious, didn't we? I like working with... I think there's a role for both. We have fully qualified architects and interior architects working in the team, so we do detailed interior architecture. But absolutely, the envelope of the building kind of is where it all starts. If you don't reference that, then you're going to have a disparity between the interior and the exterior. And I love working with architects. And I've never wanted to be one. I'm very happy not to be one. I think they do an amazing job. It's hugely complicated. And I'm very happy to leave that in their arena. You've probably got a lot more to say on this one.
I started off studying architecture, but was thrown out, but that's another story. I always employ architects, and I like their view. I almost call ourselves interior architects in a way, because the bit that I really enjoy is that fiddling with the space that exists and making it better.
Yeah.
And I find that the other part of working with architects, and this is where I absolutely agree, is that architects actually never quite understand interiors. They look at it from the outside, and they see, until they work with, for me, of course, which is very different, Marcello, but there's often just where the doors go, how the people serve from the kitchen, what you're seeing when you lie in bed. It's all of these things.
How you hang the curtains.
So, well, I forget that. But that's something else. But curtains are the worst thing of all. We'll move on. But back to the architectural side, we do everything. Been involved with the building of a couple of buildings. We do everything. We'll build onto buildings. We rarely build separate buildings. But I frequently am employed where the client has gone to the architect and isn't quite happy with the result. Mm. And I've sat in embarrassing rooms in New York where the architect says yes to everything I say, but the client sits in and then says, but. And I've had to say, I would not be sitting here if the client was happy. Mm. So I think we've got to change these things. And by the end of it, the architect, usually having eaten this bitter gall, admits and is happy to have worked with us because we bring a different pair of eyes to the project. Yes, I cannot destroy the architect's vision if he's been employed by the client, but we're used to working as a team. It's fun working as a team, but you've got to accept that we know more. And
so I know that we've gone over our time now, but if you'd like to add anything, okay. So thank you so much all for coming, and thank you for our wonderful panel, Fran Hickman, David Bentheim, and Karen Howes. Thank you. And please enjoy the rest of the London Design Festival, and have a wonderful rest of your day. Thank you.
Thank you. I just wanted to quickly say thank you. Thank you, Henrietta, Karen, David and Fran, for such a fascinating and insightful conversation this morning. We've loved hearing what truly influences you, especially on quite a personal level, from a rigorous modernist education, acclaimed designers, and having a digital library of over 40,000 images. Quite something. It's so interesting hearing about this influencer culture, and I think it's such an evolving world. I think we could debate it for a long time to come, but thank you so much, and thank you for coming. Thank you.
Thanks, Anna.